This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 18th of May, a rainy Wednesday morning. I'm Melissa Idris, and with me, Sharad Kutin and Ibrahim Sani.
Hey, good morning.
I love rainy mornings.
Well, it was actually thunderstorm last night, you know.
Was it thunderstorm?
Yeah, my baby woke up and it was.
Are your kids scared of thunder? Do they get scared?
Generally speaking, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, do you explain the science behind thunder?
No, I just say some ghost run chase them.
No wonder they're so terrified.
Oh my God, what have you done to them for the rest of their lives? They're going to be scared of thunder.
You're kind of reducing their science literacy.
We already
had this discussion, you know, Orang Mawas. The dangers of Orang Mawas thinking.
Okay, well, hopefully it's going to be a bright sunny morning, but it is lovely when it rains in the morning. I do love that. Coming up on the show today, we have a great lineup for you. Let me tell you who's coming on the breakfast grill. Dato' Ilyas Mohamed, Executive Chairman of Koperasi Amanah Pelaburan Berhad, or KAPB. Ibrahim, you spoke to him. Very interesting times for KAPB because they really want to kind of revamp the corporate identity for cooperatives in the country.
This is something quite interesting because the notion of a cooperative in the suburban or rural Malaysia is that it's more of a get-together between mom and pop and so on, instead of becoming a little bit of a corporate identity. And this is where KAPB plans to take over that kind of role. They are a investee company, so they take an ownership in other companies. Of course, the size is very small. They're not like Coop or EPF, but they're good enough to invest in some of the other companies.
So are cooperatives only for Bumiputra?
For KAPB, it doesn't have to be.
Okay.
But they have a target group for Bumiputra. So, Dato' Ilyas plans to issue REITs for KAPB. So, I'll be asking him about that and whether or not there'll be subscribers. And whether or not they are a legitimate entity altogether because they are not registered with Angkasa. And whether or not this is legal.
You know, there have been some news reports that cooperatives often give really high returns.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really good returns. Market-beating returns, in fact.
Yes. And that's because they're investing more smartly? Or?
Well, I don't know. That's really quite a question
to look at. So that's the core premise I'll be asking him. Because last year's dividends were 15%.
15%?
Yeah, 15%. Wow. So that's double, or say, Tabung Haji, and perhaps even triple the typical high yield FD of a bank. So that's right, Sharad. Are they investing in better assets? If they are, then why aren't EPF investing in those kind of assets? You know, think
are
about
they,
it.
Are they considered like a long-term thing? Because, you know, it's not like a short-term investment, right? So you put some money in there, perhaps a little bit every year, you roll over your dividend into more investment. And then over the years, perhaps if you're part of this cooperative, you get a nice little sizable sum at the end of your working life.
Yeah, possible. So I think I want to ask him that as well, whether or not there's a yearly dividend plus a big payoff at the end. I think that'll be interesting.
Great. That will be on the breakfast grill today. Dato' Ilyas Mohamed, Executive Chairman of Koperasi Amanah Pelaburan Berhad. Also coming up on the show at 8:35, current affairs. Today we get a health check on the state of the Malaysian economy. Now, the Asian region has not been spared from the global growth slowdown, and amidst this environment of volatile oil prices, weakening currencies, and also weak corporate earnings, does Malaysia still offer opportunities? And that's what we're going to explore today.
Do you think that, you know, in our daily discussions of business and that you think that, you know, that you get a sense of where the country is going? I mean, you know, we deal with business news every day,
yes,
day in, day out. There's some good news, there's some bad news. I mean, overall, do you see a sea change in the business news? Is it?
I always take two views of this because I look at the macroeconomic data and we talk to analysts, right? And then that's one point of view. And then you talk to the corporates and the CEOs on the breakfast grill and they give a different point of view. So sometimes the two views don't necessarily jive. So perhaps analysts are looking at data and they're far more pessimistic because perhaps they're looking the short term. Whereas CEOs on the Breakfast Grill saying that the shopping malls are full and they're getting they're optimistic about revenue for the next 2 to 3 years. And for me, I'm like, okay, where is this growth going? Clearly, the business sentiment is still there, but the macroeconomic data is not reflecting that.
Yeah, I think this gap between the macro data and how you do business on the top line, that's always something that is needs to be reconciled.
Yeah, and we often talk to our Market Watch commentators, right, Ibrahim? And sometimes the view on, say, China is often the same case where economists or analysts outside of China say, oh, we're not so sure, perhaps it's on the brink of a meltdown. And then you have businesses like Starbucks going gung-ho in China, yep. Apple going gung-ho in China.
Yeah, even one of our market commentators who actually went to China, Roshan, he says that there's nothing wrong there. At a consumer level, everything's really, really fine on the shipping aspect. Everything's fine.
And I think that's it. And at a consumer level. So perhaps what businesses are seeing at a consumer level, at a business economic level on the ground, is different from macroeconomic indicators that perhaps the international community look at a country's health.
Yeah, very interesting. You remember that joke that was circulating at one point about China, about how the factories were closed and the streets were deserted, and kind of predicting that this was the meltdown everybody was anticipating. And of course, it was Chinese New Year, and that was the joke, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, people had deserted the cities.
I hadn't heard of that one.
I've not heard it.
That's good.
Well, okay, I've spoiled the joke for you. You've heard the punchline.
Okay, well, we're going to be checking in with the health of the Malaysian economy with Wei Lin Tang on Current Affairs today, 8:35 a.m. And on the S&M show at 9:35, we look at two billionaire investors with two very different strategies. What have George Soros and Warren Buffett done to their portfolios recently? And more importantly, what can we read from their actions about what they feel about markets?
You remember the days when George Soros was like a persona non grata?
Mm-hmm.
When I think even the mere mention of his name would send chills down the spine of some.
I was surprised. He became a household name. People in my family were throwing his name around like he was some kind of rock star. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in the same vein, but the fact that, how often do your makciks and pakciks know of a billionaire investor, right? Yeah. I mean, but George Soros was one of them.
I think that is a case where we need to vilify a person. And I think... George Soros was...
Deserved vilification.
No, that's the thing, right? One man bring an economy down to its knees in 97? I doubt it. I think it's a collective effort. It's just that we need to put a name to the face and
unfortunately vilified, isn't it?
Well, okay, so whatever your feelings about him, you cannot deny that he has been very successful in his investment portfolio. He is people around the world watch his every move and try to duplicate, but with not quite the same level of success. And same goes for Warren Buffett. Everyone watches what he does. People read the Berkshire Hathaway newsletter and his speech at the Berkshire Hathaway meetings. Every line, it's decoded. And what does he mean? What does he think? And some people take his value investing philosophy to heart. So perhaps today we'll have a look at how their investment strategies have changed recently. We talked about Warren Buffett buying into tech stocks, Apple, for instance. Mm-hmm. What's
also
going on?
And also Didi Chuxing.
Didi Chuxing.
Yeah, yes, there you go.
Right.
So what's going on there?
So that's on the S&M show. We'll discuss that. 9:35 a.m, two billionaires with different investing strategies will pit one against the other. And coming up to 10 minutes past 6 o'clock now. So let's take a quick look at what's happening in the news today. There's been a survey done, which fairly states the obvious, I think, but it's good to get some validation. And the findings of the survey say that most Malaysians complained that road congestion was making them spend more time and money on their daily commutes than compared to a year ago.
So things have gotten worse.
Yes, over this past year.
Yeah, and I think perhaps even in more recently, and that's probably what people are focused on, I think the flash floods we've had, I was told by the taxi driver coming in this morning that there was an 8-kilometer jam on the road to KLIA yesterday. And I said, was it about the floods? And she said, no, there wasn't any rain. But it was a traffic accident. So an accident had caused this 8-kilometer jam.
Wow.
And perhaps it's that those situations in recent memory that are shaping people's view of the last year. But and also, I think it's very interesting because we've had some of our listeners ask us why we don't provide traffic news, which would be very useful for them. So they're listening to all this great content on BFM,
mm-hmm.
and then they find themselves taking the wrong turn, and then they're stuck.
Because they're distracted and they just can't by have, your witty
in fact,
comments.
The next 2 hours, they're trapped, and they have to listen to more BFM.
This is a sinister effort on our end to get them listening to us more.
That's right. Trapped
I like that. Well, to be honest with you, I have personally felt my transport costs go up in the past year. And I'm talking about from everything from the tolls going up to now me trying to avoid the tolls and getting stuck in traffic a little bit more. And even to parking rates. Parking rates have gone up, from my apartment to our office building. And I think that's one thing that's also kind of added to the woes of driving in KL.
I have a friend who actually left KL for good. He's now making a living outside of KL, somewhere in Terengganu or somewhere. And he just can't take the traffic. He just can't take the congestion. He just can't take it. He just likes the way it was. And this guy grew up in Cheras,
but
of all places.
Do you think that we as KLites have become immune to this traffic? My mother comes to visit and she is in a small town in Tanjung Malim at the moment. And she can't bear the traffic. And for me, the traffic is just part of my daily life.
Yeah.
If it means driving half an hour somewhere, just, half an hour not too far away, mm-hmm. but it takes half an hour with traffic, my mother cannot for the life of her understand why I would put myself through that.
I've lived in Klang Valley, KL or Putrajaya Jaya for the last 20 years. And the traffic has shaped where I live. So I've actually moved more than 12 times in the last 20 years. And almost always because workplace change, and I didn't want a long commute. And I remember the bad old days of me living in Ampang and having to take the minibus after work and hanging off the bus,
clinging for dear life,
and I, to the handles at the entrance, and I told myself that this doesn't make sense, it's dangerous, and why would I want to spend so much of my day in traffic? So I would always move to somewhere that was close to work.
But is that feasible though? Because as property prices get more and more expensive in the city, we tend to move further away from the city, and that just makes our commute get even longer. If you remember not too long ago, we asked our listeners, we asked everyone to kind of tweet in or text in how long it takes for them to get to the office or from their door to the desk, right? And I was surprised to hear that people get up at 4-5 o'clock in the morning, they're on the roads at 6 o'clock.
Well, hold on.
Driving.
Some of the people who get up at 4 is because they go to the gym, they have a leisurely coffee, they have a coffee, and you're waking up in a gentle way, you're not sort of rushing out of bed. I mean, so there are other reasons
but,
that people.
But also, more often, people are getting up earlier to beat the traffic, right?
Yeah. So I was working in KL, downtown KL, and I had to take Jalan Kuching to work at 6:30 or 6:45. The roads were still empty. This was 2 years ago. Last week, I was on the road at Jalan Kuching at 6:15, and it was already jammed. I wanted to send my wife to work, and I was asking my wife, "Is this normal now? People get up earlier to go to work earlier." And she said, "Yeah, this is normal. Jalan Kuching is already filled by 6:15.
Oh my goodness, I'm making so many connections here. So because of the traffic, people getting up earlier, most Malaysians not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
What does that do to our mental health
yes.
and our emotional state as mm-hmm. we go to work?
I must say, with willpower, you can change things around. I've been getting 6 hours sleep this last week because I just put my mind to it. I said, shut off my phone, shut the television off, shut whatever off, and climb into bed when it's necessary.
This is sleep hygiene, right? Because screens do not help in getting you to sleep. And a good sleep hygiene would do just that. Brush your teeth, calm yourself down, have a warm cup of whatever, Milo, whatever, and off to bed. No computers, no phones, no nothing.
And then wake up early and get to the office early.
Yes, hopefully.
Quarter past six now. We'll be back with more in just a couple of minutes. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Magic Carpet Ride there by Stephen Wolf. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Ibrahim Sani here with you this morning, 6:20 on the clock. Now, most people warn against talking about politics in polite company. They often say, what's the line they say? Don't talk about race, religion or politics at the dinner table.
Mm. I thought that's what the Home Minister tells everybody.
But what if you find yourself? Yeah. What if you find yourself in a political discussion, and what if that conversation gets heated? I mean, political beliefs, after all, hit close to home. It's a very emotive subject. So, chatting about politics can either forge an instant connection, or it can become uncomfortable. So what happens, what are the rules for talking about politics outside your group of close friends?
I just watched this short documentary by the BBC. It's about a young black American in New York who is a Trump supporter. And he can't say out loud that he is a Trump supporter because he will be picked on. University college professors will mark down his philosophy papers. His friends would not invite him for drinks over the weekend. That kind of stuff. You know, he's ostracized because of his political leanings towards Trump's kind of philosophy.
Yeah, I think it perhaps is most intense when the divisions in society are great, right? Or the chasms, right? So it might have been okay when the candidates or the people you're talking about, the parties you support, are on the same page. I mean, they're kind of middling. And mm-hmm. But in a situation where people are so divided that you feel that there's something more than politics at stake, it could be just your own trust in that human being. So how could you trust somebody who'd say, Mexicans are build a wall, rapists, or you want to ban all Muslims from entering the United States. I mean, it says something about you that you would support somebody like that, right?
Okay, so we all know of kind of birds of a feather flock together, right? So you often tend to be friends with or surround yourself with people of the same kind of similar ideals and principles. But what happens when you find yourself in a situation where you're talking to someone with the complete opposite belief?
It can happen though, Melissa, because there are sets of friends that we've had since childhood when maybe we didn't have very strong political views and we didn't choose our friends according to their politics.
Right.
We chose our friends according to how they looked, or if they had a nice lunchbox and they want to share it with us, or they were...
The pencil case had that missile loading.
Yeah, and they were like cool. They were cool.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then you keep them for life. And then as you go on through life, you find that your paths and thinking about the world has changed so much. But yet you're friends, right? And so I hear these stories all the time. What I do with these friends I had from childhood who I can no longer talk to because their view of the world is so different from mine.
So do you then avoid the emotive subject of politics, or do you think that it's good to have that kind of conversation and discussion with someone who is completely opposite you in that political divide?
I think both of you are right, because for the friends that I have had over my course of journey of growing up, right, they now have very different political leanings, definitely different than mine. But because of them being friends above all, I can have a rather intellectual discussion with them. The problem is when I meet a new person, and that person, we're trying to have a cordial discussion, but he or she has a very different political view, and because of no history background between us, we just, go.
I have to say I disagree, because I find myself far more able to discuss politics and differing views with a complete stranger than I am discussing it with perhaps a relative who holds a very different view. I find that, for instance, parents, right? Some of us have different political opinions about the state of the country and the economy from our parents. And it becomes a really difficult conversation because it often gets out of hand. We never check ourselves with our family because, we let it all hang loose. And I wonder whether that is the right way to go.
Well, I used to have a lot of arguments with my father around politics, and we were quite divided because I saw him as a cynic, as somebody who thought that, fighting for change was, ill-advised and such. And so I saw him as a cynic. He thought of me as an idealist, and you know, worse an idealist, kind of naive, okay. and because that also spoke to the kind of generational divide, right? So the idea that older people talk down to younger people who have ideals, who are, you know, kind of doe-eyed and optimistic about the world, and he was this not my dad wasn't grumpy, but I think he was cynical about the possibilities of change, and so our conversations always ended up, it was like we read the same script. It was whatever the content was, you know, whether we were talking about the Reformasi movement or politics in Singapore, it doesn't matter because the script was the same. We just changed the content bits and then you'd end up with the same argument at the end of the
okay.
day.
Okay, all right. So the themes were the same.
Yeah, and
okay.
see, that's the other problem with family, right? So on one hand, you have this axiomatic relationship with family and old friends, you know, nothing, it takes a lot to break those real bonds. But at the same time, you also have scripts and these scripts get repeated over time.
You're right.
Yeah, so we tweeted out a link to the story that tells you how you might have a civil discussion about politics.
Okay,
and
all right.
I don't know if it seems a bit silly, but anyway,
I'm looking at this article, and while I kind of get the idea of what this article is trying to say, please have a click on the link and have a read through. One of the things that I often have to remind myself, it's almost always kind of a mental check. I have to remind myself to keep an open mind whenever I'm talking about politics, because my view and my way is not the only way and the only view and the end all to all things. So even though I have very strong opinions about some things, I often have to remember, okay, what can I learn from this conversation? How can I be open to the other person's point of view? And often I find myself, while not agreeing with them in that moment in time, I go away thinking about it, or I think about it at a later point in time, thinking, oh, that's what they think. And it's really helped me as a journalist to think about the other side, I have to say.
Yeah, but you know, I have had multiple conversations with politicians across both divides, and I think that they have, you know, while keeping that open view, open mind, you know, trying to see what we can learn from this conversation.
It's a mental check.
Yeah, because, you know, half of the time they'll disappoint you because they really mean what they say, you know, in the papers and so on. And you get disappointed.
Can I ask, have you guys been in a situation where you're talking to someone who is resolutely close-minded, refuses to budge
all the
an
time.
Inch or even open a little crack.
And so the question
mind.
Is, what strategies?
Yes.
And I think, you know, sometimes humor and not repeating the script is one way of changing the course of that conversation. I just want to refer to a tweet here by Eli Rahim. Says, you make me smile when talking politics. And it's a reference to BFM, Melissa, Ibrahim, myself.
Thank you.
So, you know, and so maybe, I don't know if you're presenting the news and politics in a way that's slightly different or fresh. But hopefully, and I hope that's the reason you're smiling rather than the gaffes that we make.
Well, I would love to hear how you deal with talking about politics with strangers or even family, people who hold a different view from you. How do you navigate that conversational minefield? We'd love to find out. Are there any tactics you use, or do you avoid it completely? 016-201-9000 is the number to text or tweet us, BFM Radio.
You know, I wonder about people who live in very small communities in Malaysia, you know, out in the kampung and such, where, you know, for decades now, people have been divided, you know, often between PAS and UMNO. And, you know, we had that situation where people wanted to go to a different surau
yes,
from each other.
Absolutely. So you're describing my family back in
Negeri
Sembilan. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how painful that must be to have a situation where the politics actually comes and divides
a kampung,
right?
Yeah.
Or a community. And I think about that sometimes because we have all kinds of options when you live in the city. You don't have to. The kampung is this, you know, 1 million strong community.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're living in a really in close quarters, the question of the ethics and the civility which you have to conduct your discussions must, you know, really be, you know, of such great importance, much more than for us here, right?
Yeah, I do agree. It's a very divisive topic.
You know, this has split families all around, particularly in the rural heartland. And, you know, in Negeri Sembilan, the same thing. My family is split in Johor Bahru as well, split. And you can imagine Johor Bahru and Negeri Sembilan, the kind of political parties that will be stronger in each of the respective states. But yes, this is a perennial problem that, you know, we will face.
Well, tell us what you think. What are some of the rules of thumb that you hold true when you discuss politics with friends, family, or even strangers. Tell us. BFM Radio, at BFM Radio is our Twitter handle, and the number to text 016-201-9000. It's now 6:30 and time for news. BFM 89.9. BFM Radio. Good morning. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Ibrahim Sani. That was All Day and All of the Night by The Kinks. Okay, so earlier we were talking about how to talk politics without getting into a fight. And lots of people have weighed in on Twitter, and I'm just going to read out a few thanks to all who've tweeted in. Nick Hasudin says, try to discuss the principles behind the issue. And I think that's a valid point to make, because rather than get caught up in the emotive bits of perhaps personality and the he said, she said, but rather talk about the principles behind what a party stands for.
Yeah, a party or even, you know, in a particular event. I think the problem with personalities is that we get into the discussion of whether you can trust them. And it's, you could always hear something, I don't trust this person, I don't trust that person. And people have a reason for saying those things. It often has to do with their record. But it does kind of stymie the discussion. And I can see why Nick Hasudin would point to that. But again, in the heat of the moment, because, you know, any discussion you have with somebody you know or love is always overlaid with all those personal issues you had with them, right? And I mentioned the fact that my discussions with my father had always had to do with me trying to define myself against my father, right? As we all do with our parents, we're trying to define ourselves differently.
Yes.
And maybe we don't want to take on the politics of our parents, or we want a politics that's different from our parents as we're trying to define our own personalities. And I think it's probably true of teenagers.
Yeah, I think, you know, because my father and I, we have very different political leanings. He came from the old school days supporting the establishment. I'm not one of those guys, right? And the conversation can take a turn for the worst, or on a different day, it can have turn out to be a very intellectual kind of a discussion. So I don't know, it's like a gamble, right?
When you talk about these things. So several people have tweeted along the same line. So Ali Sani says that political conversations with her boyfriend often always escalates and gets out of hand to the point we avoid the topic altogether. And Jagdish said somewhat the same thing, saying when talking about politics is infused very deeply with religion and race, walking on thin ice. So perhaps, you know, these people perhaps believe it's best to avoid talking about it altogether. But is that the best way to do it? Do we only talk politics to the people with the same ideals and principles as we hold?
Yeah, so Sheikh Shahir says that, he says, and I quote here, I don't mind talking politics with friends. What turns me off is when the conversation becomes emotional and arguments become illogical.
Yeah, okay, so this statement can be used for both sides, right? If I'm, let's say, if I'm supporting PAS, talking to a person supporting UMNO, immediately I can deem that guy as, you know, emotional or illogical. But if I'm supporting UMNO and I'm talking to... So it
well,
really is both ways.
It's where you're standing. And often politics is emotional. It takes incredible mental willpower not to become emotional when talking about politics. I want to know, do you think that Parliament is is the best case example of talking about politics without getting into a fight?
Well, I think, okay, where I say that I think there's a difference is I think Parliament is partly a performance. Not only because it's televised, but because this is how politicians present themselves, right? It's always a bit of grandstanding going on. It's always, you know, like I'm in a charama. And I find that some politicians I've met over the years can't switch that off. So even if you're sitting in an intimate situation with them, they're still like giving
it's
a charama. And it's like,
yeah,
okay, I'm not, you know, I'm not 200,000 people. I'm just, you know, me. And maybe we could have a conversation. But so I wouldn't say that is analogous to the kind of context that we're talking about when it comes to intimates, friends and family, things or that might disrupt community. No, I don't think of Parliament in the same way. So I don't, you know, for me, Parliament is a different creature altogether.
But I think it's often, I think we should. And I think we should seek out people with different political beliefs and ideals from ourselves and talk to them. And I often worry that I might get caught into this echo chamber, into echo corridors where I'm just talking to people with similar views such as myself and my horizons never expand. So it's important to talk to those completely opposite from you.
Absolutely. And I think as journalists, we're privileged that where our profession demands that we not only talk but curious about the views of others, and in fact are open to getting a deeper understanding, to have empathy when we have a discussion. That's not true of most people who are not putting on their professional journalist cap. I mean, Melissa, you know, we went to a PACASA convention some 2 years ago, and I think was it 2 years ago?
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago, and that was a choice we made to go to PACASA to cover their convention. I have to admit, Sharad, I found it very difficult. It was for me a struggle to keep my professional journalist hat on and not get affected by the charamas that were happening, the speeches that were happening, how everyone was so passionate about what was being said. And I struggled with it, but I think it was for the better that I was exposed to it.
I mean, you know, look, I have a lot of liberal friends, Ibrahim, you know, and when I tweeted out that I was at the PACASA convention and that I had walked up to Ibrahim Ali and shook his hand, some people said, how could you do that? You know, I would be sickened, you know, because Ibrahim Ali doesn't exactly, isn't emblematic of liberal progressive values in the Malaysian political spectrum, mm-hmm. right? So, but I said, no, that for me, it's a professional courtesy to introduce myself as a journalist, and also I have no differences on a personal level with them. And for me, it's not personal, right? It's political in the sense that I can put that in that little political box.
Yeah. Okay. So not many people are as fortunate as you are, Sharad, where you have little boxes of ideals.
Yeah. And, how do you do that? Compartmentalize.
And you compartmentalize. You know. All right. For this issue, I'm going to put it in this box, and so nothing can be personal with you. And I really admire that kind of behavior. But not many people are like that.
And I have to agree with Jagdish on this. Sometimes people confuse politics with race and religion, and one gets intermingled with the other. Not many people can compartmentalize politics into your little box and have that discussion without getting emotional.
So Steve just chimed in. Steve said that politics is predominantly religion and race, so it's very difficult for you to discuss this when you talk about context in the context of politics in the sense of religion and race.
But, you know, I must say, I mean, look, I don't want to mischaracterize. It's not like I'm, you know, a journalist all the time. Right. I have deep views, and if you follow me on Twitter, at Sharad Kutin, you will know that I have very strong views.
That was a shameless plug.
It was. But, you know, but there's another side of me where I feel not just a professional duty to be open, but I think I have an intellectual duty as well. And so I'm interested in constantly challenging myself, and I have to fight my own instincts. Of course I have a deep, you know, I get angry. I think a lot of us do get angry about the politics of our times. It's so divisive. It's been so toxic and corrosive. At the same time, you need to kind of move the situation, the conversation along. But how do you do that if you only act from that?
But, you know, sometimes if you don't have the conversation because it's so emotive and it can often boil over into a fight, most people avoid the topic, and that breeds political apathy. And that, I think, is a really dangerous situation when you decide, I'm not going to have this conversation because it's just too hard.
Oh, nothing's going to change, if I get into an argument.
Yeah, so cynicism is probably the worst result of this, right? And you choose a kind of cynical silence because, you don't believe anything will change. I mean, that really must be the death knell of a democracy when we feel that we really have nothing to say to each other because we don't believe we can change each other's position. We must believe that in a conversation, not only that we can change the position of the other person, but that our positions can change too.
So this provides an opportunity for people to be bipartisanship, to try to understand what the other person is trying to push forward. Not necessarily, because right now everything is about religion, race. If not, it's going to be about money politics. It's going to be about how you make money in politics. It's always these negative connotations, right?
Do you think that it is polite, or do you think it's acceptable to ask somebody about their political leanings? Do you think that should be a question?
I think that's okay.
It's okay. But okay, in his one, he has a really interesting analogy. He says it's like supporting a football team.
Oh.
And the question is, should politics be like football and football loyalties, the club loyalties, where you're in for life? And I think that's true of a lot of people, especially, and I don't know if it's just in the kampong, but, you know, there is this idea that parties are there for life and that there's all these systems put in place so that you become a loyalist for life.
Yeah, Ali Sumo Hidup kind of thing.
Yeah, rather than saying, well, the party shifted its ground and I no longer believe in the party and it's the party's platform that I'm loyal to, not the party itself, right, the institution. So... Mm-hmm. And I don't know, should politics be like football?
I really like that analogy, Hiswani. Thanks for tweeting in. Our handle is at BFM Radio, or you can text us at 016-201-9000. How do we talk politics without it descending into a fight? I do think good sportsmanship is part of that, you know?
And keeping a smile on your face, I think, remembering that the other side is not the enemy.
Okay.
And I think, this is part of the problem with authoritarian politics. Governments think of citizens as potential enemies, or in very divisive situations, we think of other citizens, our fellow citizens, as enemies once they disagree with us.
6:50 right now, and here's Lenny Kravitz with Are You Gonna Go My Way on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.